Итак, в прямом эфире Владимир Путин.
Задержка зарплат.
Колеса отваливаются.
Проблема действительно обострилась.
Цены подросли существенно.
Трудно нащупать дно.
Значит, поедем в Крым, там тоже хорошо.
Каким еще врагам России ударят наши ВКС?
От тайги до британских морей Красная Армия всех сильнее.
Страна может замереть на 4 месяца и будет существовать.
Я тоже доволен, у меня тоже все хорошо.
It happens every spring. In Russia's longest-running reality show, Vladimir Putin plays Vladimir Putin on television and pretends to care about the concerns of ordinary Russians. Along with the Kremlin leader's year-end press conference and his State of the Nation speech, the annual call-in show provides an opportunity for Putin to send a message to the Russian people, the Russian elite, and the outside world. So what was the message in the Putin show this year, and how successful was Putin in sending it? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hey there, guys.
Hey. And also joining us from Moscow, also via Skype, is journalist and playwright Natalia Antonova, the former editor of Moscow News and one of the more colorful figures on Russian social media. Welcome back, Natalia. Good to see you.
Hi, good to see you, too.
So here are my takeaways from yesterday. First, obviously, domestic politics appears to be back in vogue. If 2 years ago Putin was talking about Novorossiya in a new Russian empire, yesterday he was talking about dairy products, as Alexander Clarkson of King's College memorably tweeted yesterday. And I must say, I did learn a lot more about milk production than I'd care to know. Second, Putin appeared in his own way to be reaching out to the West. Most of the usual inflammatory rhetoric was absent. He said Barack Obama's a decent man. I never thought I'd heard those words come out of his mouth. He even said it'd save Poroshenko and Erdogan if they were drowning. He wants a rapprochement, but he clearly wants one on his terms. And finally, Putin appeared to be uncharacteristically off his game yesterday. He usually shines in this format. He usually looks like he's enjoying himself. Yesterday, he looked bored. Usually, he looks like he's commanding the material. Yesterday, he really looked like, to me at least, like he was reading from a teleprompter or he was getting instructions in the earpiece about what he was supposed to be saying. He seemed kind of robotic and just didn't. I don't know if you guys shared this, but this is the feeling I got. Maybe he wasn't feeling well. Maybe he was preoccupied. Maybe something's going on behind the scenes. But from my foxhole, something appeared to be off. Mark, what was your takeaway?
Yeah, I agree that his manner was distinctly less impressive. I mean, in terms of the subject matter, I mean, actually, if you think about it, last year was also very heavily about the economy, very heavily about seeking to kind of convey reassurance on domestic issues. But even then, at least it had some of the more memorable moments, even if it's the kind of his bizarre, lengthy sort of segue from can my husband get me a puppy?
Right.
Through to he might buy you furs instead. I mean, this was also lacking most of the sort of the zinger moments. I mean, whether it's anything to do with Putin, I think it's also because actually, how many times can you say basically keep calm and carry on,
right,
without it beginning to sound rather threadbare, without it actually meaning that you are out of control? Because this is actually, for me, one of the key leitmotifs, was without him necessarily wanting to convey this, how often he actually conveyed his own impotence. Not in the sense of, yes, fine, he can get the roads fixed when someone complains. But when you had him, for example, being asked about bureaucrats hassling entrepreneurs, he said, you know, we're working on this, but when it comes down to it, this is just the bureaucrat's mentality. When he was asked about Chechnya, it's, well, you've got to understand the Chechens, they're a hot-blooded people.
I can't believe he said that.
I mean, even bizarrely on this question about, who would you save from drowning first, Erdogan or Poroshenko? You know, I mean, it was a smart-ass and quite effective answer when he said, well, the trouble is, you know, if someone really wants to drown, what can you do? But even that, actually, again, it conveyed time and again this almost sense of he can intervene in micro-scale stuff, But actually, he was conveying considerable levels of impotence on the macro scale issues.
Yeah, no, and I would add, Mark, you say you note the business is being harassed by the authorities. As he was speaking, wasn't IKEA getting raided?
Exactly. But though, I mean, again, I think that tends to be a ritual almost. I mean, I noted that Ekaterina Shulman, who's always a very sort of sharp observer, she actually sort of renamed this the ritual line. But part of the sort of ritual seems to be that someone gets raided.
Right.
During sort of Putin's phone-in.
I found it kind of also curious when the anchor was signing off. He's like, well, we've gone for 3.5 hours and we've already opened a criminal case, you know, which was like just like not even
hiding
this thing.
It was so much less deferential than often. I mean, you know,
I thought so too.
So, I mean, let's face it, you know, I mean, he always tends to go on. He was, I found, and I wasn't, as it were, contractually bound to watch the whole lot, but he was at times so extraordinarily tedious. And even
my
the
head
host
hurt
would be interrupting to try and sort of almost chivy him along.
Yeah, no, it was pretty surprising. I mean, the other thing, as I noted this morning on the Morning Vertical, I mean, I learned that Russian dairy products are bad. I learned the roads are bad. I learned salaries aren't being paid. I learned kindergarten, schools and hospitals are being closed. Remind me again, why is this guy a good leader? You know, that was one of the other takeaways from this. I mean, it kind of it highlighted how truly bad the situation was in Russia. I learned more from the questions than I did from the answers, I think.
No, I mean, in fairness, though, no Western leader ever exposes themselves to anything like this.
But all Western leaders are accountable to their populations, which Putin isn't.
Well,
so the Western leaders don't need to do this. This is a subsidy. I know you've said that many times. And,
yeah, but the interesting thing is, I mean, I think if any Western leader did, then frankly, you'd expect all the questions to be about complaints. That, I think, is par for the course. And again, I think...
Western leaders do town halls. I mean, I've seen Obama do town halls on specific issues where he had to face down serious questions from the population. It happens.
But then...
For 4.5 hours or 3.5 hours,
but,
no, but...
But not splashed, also not sort of made in this kind of sort of massive sort of public spectacle. The thing that's right, it was not as it were, yeah, of course, everyone's going to raise problems. They always do. I mean, apart from the sort of carefully staged... You know, Vladimir Vladimirovich,
why are you such a great leader? Yeah.
but the interesting thing was actually this time I felt, compared with previous times, and, you know, given that the questions weren't all exactly, shall we say, surprises to him, he had almost nothing to offer. I mean, he basically was just simply, well, you know, it'll get better. Hold on there. You know, things will be fine. It was basically, this was a 3.5 hour motivational poster of a cat holding onto a branch saying, hang in there. there was just nothing more.
Let's bring Natalia in here. Natalia, what was your takeaway? You, like me, you had to watch this whole damn thing.
Yeah, I had to watch this whole thing, and I was really tired by the end. And I would have to note that, I mean, I think the producers might have been different this time around, because you definitely noticed how, like, the pace of it and the way it was staged. I mean, it is always very much a staged event in most ways. But the way it was staged this year, it was kind of, in terms of, you know, if you analyze it as reality TV, which is what it is, it's reality TV, and it was staged poorly. And I think that Putin was just kind of bored with it the whole time.
Yes. I thought the anchors looked bored. I thought the audience even looked
bored. They were bored. Yeah, they were bored too. And they were kind of annoyed to be there. He was also, I mean, he was giving them annoyed looks throughout. There was definitely no rapport there. And I don't know, maybe, you know, like if you're really going to get into criminology and say, like, oh, you know, they did this to show that, you know, it wasn't fake, you know, they wanted to add the real element. I don't think it's true, though. I think it genuinely just wasn't, it didn't work as TV this year. I think that also just the fact that he does this every year, it has been doing it, I think, since 2004.
Yeah, this is the 14th.
So. I think it's also just a very human thing of, okay, we're doing this again. It's the same thing every damn time. I think that was on his mind. And eventually you do just get bored with this format, but you also can't abandon it because they don't know what really else to do with it.
So, well, it's a legitimizing ritual almost.
It is. And I also felt that he kind of did have something to offer. And what he did to offer was really sinister, because he kind of kept saying, you know, when he talked about Kadyrov, when he criticized Kadyrov, when he fielded a question about United Russia, he was always going back to this issue of, let's get back to reality. Let's get back to stability. Yes, United Russia is a bad party. He basically admitted this, but he said they're a stabilizing force. He admitted that Kadyrov is a dangerous man who affects Russian stability in his own kind of detrimental way. But he was also saying, but guys, look at the political reality. What, for me, what he was basically hinting at the whole time on the show was that, okay, yes, I know you're tired. I know there's, you know, the ruble has collapsed and this is happening and the roads aren't being built and you're all angry. But guess what? It's, you know, it's either me or like chaos and bloodshed. Yeah. That's what I got from it. It just was very understated this year, I think, because everybody's kind of tired of the format and so is he. But I think that's what I was really reading between the lines there.
Yeah, the triumphalism wasn't there. The swagger wasn't there. And I'm wondering how much to read into that. Mark, you had an interesting tweet yesterday about like how gentle he treated Kadyrov. I mean, if you want to expand on that a little bit, because I thought I retweeted it and I posted it on our live blog. I thought it was interesting because he did, the more I thought about it. But you got to understand where this guy came from. He used to fight in the forest. And now, what was your thinking behind
it? Yeah, I mean, again, I think this is a fascinating thing. I mean, he could have just simply turned around and sort of more or less said, Kadyrov, he is a fine, upstanding patriot. There's nothing to be said against him, which would clearly have been nonsense. But nonetheless, at least it would have been a full-throated, full-blooded bit of nonsense. As it was, and again, I think this goes back to the sort of, you know, the point that's been made before. I mean, he was essentially admitting, yeah, exactly. You know, he is a pain, but what can you do? I mean, he actually sort of basically said, look, you know, at least he's no longer in the forest shooting at us. You know, in other words, you know, he is no longer a rebel. And yeah, I mean, and this does have that point about, look, it's however miserable this situation is, the alternative is that much worse. I mean, last year I thought he was fairly low key, but I thought he was actually quite effective because I think last year he was playing the chief executive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he wasn't playing the triumphalist national leader. He was playing the competent chief executive who's got all the facts at his fingertips. Yes, of course, there are certain problems, but don't worry, we're doing X, we're doing Y, this index is going better, we're producing more electricity, you know, all the kind of stuff. But at least, you know, there was a certain energy to it. This time, precisely, there was no energy to it or anything like that. There was, and so more or less his answer is basically, look, live with it, guys, because nothing better is going to be coming down the pike. And in a way, in that respect, the Kadyrov thing
is a metaphor almost for the whole thing.
For the lot. And you see, here we go back to this whole business of this as being a legitimizing ritual. And yeah, I mean, on one level, they're stuck. They're screwed. They have established this. They could not turn around and say, we're not doing it next year. Without us reading all kinds of negative things into it, and also the Russian people themselves thinking what's going on.
I love the idea that they care about what we think. But
absolutely. Well, I mean, me. I don't know about you. But the bottom line is that if what you've more or less got is, in effect, going back to trying to evoke the 1990s without saying so, I'm really not convinced. In 2000s, that worked. To an extent, but it's a declining asset.
Right.
I'm really not sure how far yesterday actually really did bring any degree of legitimacy. I think quite the opposite. I think because this has become a regime that is so dependent on one person and the mythologies that swirl and surround that one person, anything that does not actively continue to rebuild it, I think implicitly denies it.
Right.
And I think that's the problem. Yeah.
How is this playing in Moscow? I've gotten some sense from reading the press, but how is this being reacted to in Moscow?
I think people are fairly cynical about it, you know, 14 years on. Even people who are the target audience, like people who are older, right, more conservative, they know that it doesn't affect their daily lives. Whatever happens on that show is really going to make no impact either way. They know it's pageantry, basically. It's TV pageantry. I think that in general, I'm very kind of distrustful of all these continuous reports that, oh, well, you know, the price of beets is really going up, so Putin will be out in a few weeks. You know, like there's no sense of that, obviously. I think people are kind of contentious to, I mean, I think basically like the overwhelming sense is, okay, as long as the government leaves me alone, I'm not really going to care either way about what's happening. I think we're back to like this kind of apathy, really, with regard to these things, these events. I mean, you saw it with Crimea this year because they had the big concerts, you know, celebrating the Crimean annexation as they did the year before, and they were paying people to show up. You know, this really well-known journalist was paid 300 rubles, I think. It's sad to contemplate, but for a lot of people now, 300 rubles is like a lot of money, even as the ruble devalues.
Even as it devalues,
but because people's real wages have gone down. So you're going to show up to these things or you're going to care for them because you think you might be able to get some material gain out of it, not because you genuinely believe in it or you think it's going to, you know, affect you either way.
I was struck by a message I got on Facebook as this thing was going on. Peter Pomerantsev, who knows a thing or two about show business, he used to work in Russian television, said this is just really, really bad show business. He said Volodin sucks. Basically, seriously, the implication, I guess, is Surkov never would have let this happen.
Yeah, Surkov is more creative. I think if they had stuck with Surkov, I think they would have predicted this kind of flagging interest, and I think they would have changed the format and done something else. Because this is what Surkov is known for, and this is what he's kind of good at, is that he's good at kind of innovating propaganda and making it more interesting, you know, and making it more effective. Let's face it, propaganda is effective, but it's especially effective when it's flexible and it changes with the times.
Right.
And obviously they don't have that element there right now. So yeah, it's not that interesting anymore.
Now, moving from the show business aspect of this, the propaganda aspect, the reality television, and into the policy, did either of you see any policy signals come out of this? I mean, I saw a couple maybe policy signals, although they weren't terribly clear. The question about Kudrin was interesting. That question didn't get asked by accident. But then again, I mean, you would think Putin would have been much more prepared to knock this out of the park. But he seemed to suggest that maybe Kudrin's going to come back in some advisory capacity. Reuters was speculating that maybe that signaled that there's going to be a shift in economic policy. I'm skeptical of that. As I said in my postgame wrap up on Facebook Live yesterday, I just don't see it happening because the changes Kudrin advocates are impossible in this regime. The wholesale economic changes that Kudrin's advocating would upend the entire political system because it's based on rent-seeking and kleptocracy. And to put true liberal economic reform into that system would mean that system ceases to exist. That's one signal I saw. I mean, maybe they're trying to signal that they're open to some kind of economic reform. On the West, the more conciliatory rhetoric, referring to the United States as a partner, referring to Barack Obama as a decent man, referring to Turkey as a friendly nation, even though we have problems with their leaders who are financing terrorists. I mean, there was some sign there. Again, this is not a new signal. Putin wants a rapprochement, but he wants a rapprochement on his terms and on his terms alone. And his terms are unacceptable to the West. So I'm not sure that's any kind of a policy signal. Mark, you did a nice post yesterday on the security takeaways. What did you see in terms of policy signals?
Well, I'm precious little. In some ways, this is, look, you know, it's like the case of if you put infinite number of monkeys in front of typewriters, one will randomly type Shakespeare. But likewise, you can't have Putin talk for 3 hours, 40 minutes and not give some indications that we might think of as policy steers. But precisely, I feel that if they really were signaling policy shifts or signaling policy priorities, they would have been very, very clearly flagged up as such. Exactly. I mean, I think, you know, otherwise what we got was a lot of it the same. I mean, Kudrin, the whole issue of Kudrin coming back, you know, this kind of glorious prince across the water. I mean, we see that time and time again. And to be honest, I think at this stage, it's merely a sort of a symbolic way of saying we have not completely lost our minds. We realize, alas, that market economics sometimes matters, and we'd like to have someone who understands them, sort of responsible for policy. But that's, I think, very different from tackling the nuts and bolts. I think this is the thing. It's actually the nuts and bolts issues. 3 points. I mean, one is Kudrin, exactly. It's clear that if he does come back, he will expect a sort of reform policy, which would be very, very hard, if at all possible, to reconcile with the current system, and very hard to reconcile with any position other than either prime minister or some kind of extraordinarily high-powered kind of presidential economics sort of super czar.
Right.
Yeah. And
which is, you know, what he was going for, but it seems to have been nixed by Volodin.
Yeah, well, and
I
suspect
believe the rumors that were out there,
speaking for a whole bunch of other people,
right,
who I think were also very, very concerned. It's worth also mentioning, it was quite fun when the unedited text message, you know, when Shoigu going to become prime minister?
Right, yeah, that's so, right.
Which I'm probably actually did Shoigu no good whatsoever.
Yeah.
So anyway, so with Kudrin, it's a symbolic gesture rather than one. Likewise with the West, the Russians are always deploying the rhetoric of partnership. It's always, look, us, we're ready there to be good neighbors and make a deal. It's just, why is the West so horrible to us?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think this was much, much the same. I mean, you know, again, to an extent, almost run on autopilot. But the third thing, I mean, going on to the issues of sort of defense issues, I mean, one of the really striking things was there was a defense industrialist who sort of came up and sort of, you know, was worried about sort of potential cuts, and are we going to have to go back to making frying pans like in the bad old 90s, as if they're sort of next to that stage. And he was reassured that, look, you know, all arms of government are having to make economies, but don't worry, the sort of state order of, you know, the arms procurement budget won't be touched. Well, look, Here's a basic economics thing. Money you spend on thing A, you can't spend on thing B. If he's cutting the defense spend, which he is having to do, and he wants to maintain the arms procurement spend. Well, where's the rest of the money going to come from? Is it going to come from personnel costs? Because at the same time, you're committed to recruiting more sort of professional volunteers. From training, which is what actually makes your army effective. From upkeep, which actually means that people don't constantly dodge the draft and get miserable and turn to crime. I mean, there are no spare pots of money lying around.
And the biggest pot is procurement, right?
Exactly. And frankly, the most padded.
It's completely inefficient.
And at the same time, we've got the minimum wage is being raised by 21%, which it should. I mean, let's be honest. But nonetheless, that's a cost. There's a lot of things which actually are going to be costs. We're almost certainly going to see pensions being increased a month before the Duma elections. There happens to be a pensions review that will just conveniently come right at that moment. I mean, I think this is the thing. On the one hand, he doesn't have any proper policy options. So at the moment, he's back to, frankly, this. It's quite ironic that he actually criticized the Soviets for overspending on the military, because actually he's back to a very late Soviet policy, which is that when there's problems, we just throw money at it. Money we may not have, but nonetheless, we'll throw money at it.
You also noted his going back to Kadyrov, that he signaled that Kadyrov was untouchable.
I think, again, to allow a Kadyrov question on this show of all places, you know, again, a big national show, and to have him give such a meek answer that more or less said, look, yeah, Kadyrov is a crazy so-and-so, but what can you do? I'm paraphrasing slightly, but only slightly.
Right.
I think that basically gave out a signal that Putin is not willing to even contemplate anything to clip Kadyrov. Right.
I thought it was interesting that question came from Sergei Dorenko, too, the television anchor, former Channel 1 television anchor, who's currently on Golis Rossi, right, if I'm not mistaken. Natalia, what was your takeaway in terms of policy? Did you see any policy signals?
Well, I think we're going to see possibly more healthcare cuts, because a really, really famous actor, Konstantin Khabensky, very popular figure, got up and said, hey, last year you said that, you know, you're going to approve these policy measures to get kids on life support machines out of ICU so they can, you know, be at home. There's a really big drive for that last year. And he did say it, and now it's not happening. And Khabensky was pressing him as to why, and he was basically saying, oh, well, there's no money. But of course, as we know, and because I know a lot about Russian healthcare, it is seven times more costly to keep a child like that in the hospital than it is to send them home. So I don't know why there was that kind of blunder, to be honest, because it's really not hard to look up these figures and not make the president look like a complete fool just then and there. But, you know, it happened. And also they were talking about ICUs, and that's a really big problem for Russia as well, that people are not allowed into ICUs to say goodbye. You know, my father-in-law just died in Moscow, and I was not allowed to say goodbye to him. I mean, he was unconscious. He probably would not have heard me, but at least I could have been there to kind of like hold his hand and whatever. Right. And I couldn't do it. This even happens to children, and it's complete barbarous. I mean, even the NHS, which is, you know, overstretched, overworked, whatever, will allow you in to say goodbye to your loved ones. It's just, you know, it's standard human treatment of your patients. In Russia, that's not happening. And Putin, like, he was telling Khabensky, oh, yeah, I understand, but he really saw no enthusiasm there, because he knows that, once again, in order for these policies to be implemented, you have to go after the doctors, you have to go after the middle administration. And there really just doesn't seem to be enough of a political will to make that stuff better, because they can't, because of all the money problems. I mean, they're optimizing healthcare in Russia, and since they're optimizing it, they can't then very well turn around and say, but you actually have to do more and be decent to your pay. You know, it's kind of like they have to pick and choose what they can achieve right now. So I thought that was important. I mean, it's important for every Russian who was actually tuning into that program to try to read between the lines and get some answers. And also thought that as far as policy goes, it was basically very much like an admission, okay, like we have like chaos on the local level. And I think before in recent years, it was more like, yes, we have chaos on local levels, but, you know, it's fine because the boyars are bad, the czar is good, and the czar will take care of you. The kind of sense I was getting this year was, yes, we have chaos on a local level, and you have to appeal to the president to solve a problem that you should be appealing to your mayor for example, who's not going to do anything for you,
right?
You know, because the system is completely rotten through. So you still have to do that. But, you know, we're also kind of possibly like not going to be as enthusiastic about that either, you know, because we have bigger problems to deal with. Right. So for me, it was like, this very kind of gentle admission to Russia that, yes, we understand that your local bureaucracy sucks. You know, once again, when he was talking about United Russia, you could actually hear the contempt in his voice for the ruling party of the country. When you hear
which
that
he created.
Yeah, which he created. Which he created. But then he also kind of artfully, because he knows he had Surkov there to kind of guide him through the process of where you have this party, which is a disappointment. It's not a success. But its failures do not reflect on the good czar. You know, it's the bad boys. And I think that Surkov did a really good job of kind of differentiating that. And now it seems that there's no energy there to even like go after this image problem and say that, you know, United Russia is bad, but you got to put up with it because the alternative is so much worse. Mm. So there you have it.
Yeah.
No, which is a great way to sort of basically kick off your Duma campaign.
Right. Well, as Leonid Bershetsky pointed out in his column for Bloomberg yesterday, playing off of this does not bode well as going into the Duma elections five months down the road.
Well, Zhirinovsky, I think, and the communists, they are a pet opposition, but that doesn't mean they don't sometimes bite the hand that feeds them. I mean,
right.
They do that frequently. They test their limits quite a bit because I think they're both veterans of the political system and they know how quickly things can shift in Russia. So it would be interesting to see how they're going to act later this year. I mean, maybe they're just too old and they don't care anymore and they just want to be kind of left alone and go through the motions. Or they're going to be a little bit more forceful. I don't know.
Yeah, just, no, a few weeks ago, Mark was arguing the communists are going to make a big splash or a big comeback.
I mean, whether they do that. But I think the interesting thing is clearly all kinds of, as it were, pre-rigging measures have been introduced this time round to try and ensure that United Russia gets the biggest share it possibly can of the votes cast. But again, if we're talking about legitimating rituals, it's not just that in the Duma elections they need to have United Russia winning properly, winning suitably, I meant to say. It's they also need to have a good turnout, because again, that's part of the whole mythology or whatever. And that, for me, I think is going to be the real problem. They can actually sort of fiddle the actual proportions of votes cast, but actually just simply getting enough people to the polling stations, I think, is going to be a problem. And all this cynicism and this lack of enthusiasm that, frankly, you know, if Putin basically is clearly not interested, why people should expect, you know, the good burghers of Tula to rush out in hordes to vote. So I think that's probably where
Kadyrov will get his 199% out. That's for sure.
Absolutely, especially now.
Before we wrap it up, just one thing that kind of also jumped into my mind is that, you know, a lot of attention was paid to the conciliatory rhetoric, the lack of inflammatory rhetoric, maybe is a better way of putting it, toward the West. But just days before Putin's call-in show, Russian warplanes buzzed and did a simulated attack on a U.S. destroyer in the Baltic Sea. And sometimes maybe we pay too much attention to what Putin says. And we should just keep paying more attention to what Russia does. Are we reading too much into what he says?
I'm actually going to suggest the opposite.
Uh-huh.
Because when it comes down to it, actually, Putin and the Russians do tend to basically tell us, in broad terms, what they want and what they're going to do. Now, fine, they catch us out in the detail, when they come out of Syria or go into Syria or take Crimea or whatever. But in broad terms, actually, this is not a regime that completely sort of fails to inform us of its priorities. When it comes down to it, I mean, buzzing a ship with your plane,
25 meters from the boot.
Doesn't matter if it's 20 meters or 50 meters in the sense of, I mean, yeah, it's in one little it adolescent geopolitics. But when it comes down to it, it's meaningless.
Trolling, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, but trolling is meaningless. Trolling is only important whether it's an internet or a fighter bomber in how it makes us feel. In the grand scheme of things, it is, I would say, trivial.
Yeah, I agree.
Natalia, any other?
I hate to be boring. I hate to be boring and agree with Mark, but I agree with
you. It's never boring to agree with Mark.
That's true.
You can never go wrong if you agree with Mark. All right, well, on that note, we'll shift gears. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and switch to another spectacle that appeared on Russian television this week. The incredibly botched attempt to paint opposition leader Alexei Navalny as a paid agent of U.S. and British intelligence. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us from Moscow, also via Skype, is journalist and playwright Natalia Antonova, former editor of the Moscow News and one of the more colorful figures on Russian social media. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter @PowerVertical.
Специальная операция «Дрожь».
Криминальная переписка. Коррупционера, рецидивиста Алексея Навального.
Благодаря вооруженному перевороту на Украине
вывезли около 60 серверов.
Совершенно секретно центральной разведки США МИ-6.
Изменение конституционной системе в СССР.
Речь о деньгах.
И снижение авторитета Владимира Путина.
Агент Соломон – это Уильям Браудер, мошенник, сколотивший миллионы в России.
Я научу вас держать за яйца монстров российской экономики.
А такой Браудер Лондону не нужен. Борец с коррупцией звучит респектабельно.
Tinker Tailor Navalny spy. That Russian state television do a hit job on Alexei Navalny is hardly surprising. They've been doing this kind of thing for years. And that they would accuse him of being an agent of Western intelligence services is also no shocker. It's a standard talking point. But that Russia One would do such a sloppy job on this in a primetime report riddled with so many inconsistencies and easily disproved falsehoods was indeed a bit surprising. Or perhaps not. Maybe they just don't care. Maybe the goal wasn't to convince, but to send a message that Navalny is now fair game. And Navalny's apparently decided that the best defense is a good offense, and he's called on the FSB to investigate the allegations against him. Mark, what's your take on this mess?
Well, I mean, I confess at first I feel, because this is clearly a piece of staged drama, really ought to kind of defer to the playwright.
Okay.
To see what she thinks.
Okay, let's hear from the playwright. Natalia, what do you see?
Well, I see that it's a staged drama, but it really doesn't matter what they actually say, because to the majority of the population who are watching these broadcasts, you know, all you have to do is really just string a bunch of words together. CIA, Navalny, blah, 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 Browder, and it all makes sense. I'm not saying this because I think all these people who are watching are idiots, but I'm saying it because the expectations, the standards that Russian television is held to are extremely low. They're low in every regard. It doesn't matter if you're going after an opposition leader who's, you know, not even that prominent to most of Russia, you know, outside of Moscow and St. Petersburg, for example. It doesn't matter if they're doing that or if they're reporting on a new chicken farm in your town. They're, you know, people just don't expect TV to have good standards. Nobody demands good standards. People are really cynical about their media, and they kind of assume already that their media is going to lie and twist facts and not give them the whole picture.
But you don't think they could take care to make sure, for example, that the dates line up, that Navalny isn't answering correspondences that are asked later?
You'd think so, but the standards, it's kind of like, it's this thing when, I like this, there's a woman a few years ago who was talking actually about a massacre in the Kubine region. She said that lack of accountability is a progressive disease. If you start out with very little accountability, as you go on, you get worse and worse and worse at keeping up appearances. You know, these people genuinely, I think, do not care at this point. They don't care what they're putting out. And I think for a lot of them, you do talk to Russian TV executives and whatever, you know, there's an opposition writer, Arkady Babchenko, you know, spoke to a woman who actually, she did like a broadcast that was targeting him, and they knew each other from before, from college, I think. And he was like, hey, what are you doing? You know me, you know that these are lies. And she's like, well, yeah, I know, Arkady, I'm sorry, but I've got two kids, blah, blah. You know what I mean? It's that level of, it's that kind of attitude. These people are not out there trying to win awards and be proud of their jobs. They're just, you know, they're just getting by, basically. That's what it's like. So it really doesn't surprise me that the standards are getting worse and worse over time.
But everybody was able to point this out, that the English was just way off. You know, the CIA apparently has the worst English speakers in the world.
Surprise, right?
The voices of Navalny and Ponomarev were completely off. The dates didn't add up. The whole thing was just incredibly botched, but they presented it with such fanfare. Mark, what was your takeaway?
I think I'd agree that there's an element in which they don't really feel they need to care too much about the detail. Because I mean, when you say everyone was able to point this out, you mean everyone in a particular kind of either Western or West-oriented critical kind of perspective. And I mean, I think back to, remember reading late Soviet sort of adventure novels that also had a clear sort of political dimension. Things like Yulian Semyonov's TASS is Authorized to Announce, Alexander Prokhanov's A Tree in the Center of Kabul, which always involved these nefarious Western plots. Really clumsily done. You know, no attempt to even make the minimum kind of accommodations to actually how things really are handled. But the point is, first of all, the readership have no kind of corroborating experience. It's not like they're being told about how, I don't know, you know, a traffic cop pulls you up, because they might think, well, I remember that time when someone pulled me up. So they haven't got that kind of benchmark. But secondly, I mean, again, going back to what Natalia was saying, this is all just simply about kind of adding a general pile of stuff onto the heap. No one cares about the quality of each individual bit. It's just you want to build enough of a pyre that sort of gives this sense of, my God, there must be something in it. But I mean, also, I mean, I wonder actually at how quickly this was done, because we've suddenly seen this flurry, and in some ways, it might even sort of link to the whole concerns they had about the Panama Papers.
No, that crossed my mind.
You had
too.
Kind of Peskov jumping up and saying, "Oh, it's going to be this sort of, you know, information hit against us," and I think in part because they didn't really know exactly what would be in the Panama Papers, and then probably suspected it was going to be worse than it really was.
Yeah, I think they were a bit relieved, actually.
Then you had, again, in Speciality Correspondent, this program, The Information War Against Russia. Again, a shoddy piece of, I wouldn't even call it bad journalism. It wasn't even an attempt at journalism. It's just bad propaganda. And then you had this. And, you know, it might well be that this was something that was kind of knocked together in a hurry, because I think probably the graphics probably took rather more time than the content. But again, the main thing is just going to be something that hits all the right notes. You have Navalny, you have Browder, you have the CIA.
You have MI5.
delighted to see that the British, but the perfidious Albion remains this kind of global superpower of the secret services. You have the Moscow Helsinki group being sort of name-checked as essentially this kind of cat's paw of Western intelligence funneling money to Navalny. Again, if we go back to this parallel of the trolls in their troll farms with their little checklist of what they have to say today, it's much the same. So in that respect, I mean, I think what we are is in a situation in which, quite frankly, they don't really care about quality. They don't really care about the detail. They just want to kind of give this general sense of, once again, that the West is out to get us and that those people who criticize us are just simply pawns thereof.
What do we make of Navalny's response? I mean, he went out, he called on the FSB very publicly, published the letter on his blog, calling on the FSB to investigate these allegations against him. Best defense is a good offense, I guess. What was he trying to do there? Do you think he's really worried that this is a precursor to a potential investigation against him on very what would be very serious charges?
I think he's realistic enough to know that, you might say, if they want to have an investigation against him, they'll have an investigation against him. There is nothing he can do in practical terms to prevent that. What he can do is two things. A is raise the profile and thus the potential political cost of any next sort of generation show trial, which is what he's doing. But secondly, also have a bit of fun with it. There is that.
So Navalny's trolling the Kremlin.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, from his point of view, what has he got to lose? Absolutely nothing. If they want to turn around tomorrow and say that he is a rapist and an arsonist, they can do so. There's nothing he can do about that. But on the other hand, by sort of seeming to cooperate, by making a splash, at least in the West, then at least he can, as I said, increase his own political cost.
Natalia, what are your thoughts?
Well, I was just thinking that, you know, one thing that agents really hate, I mean, and Mark is more of the expert here, but you know, they do kind of hate just extra paperwork. I mean, this is what everybody hates, right? And just the fact that he's basically, from my position, it's kind of like, you know, he was publicly kind of a little bit setting the first bet against Russian television, because it's like, here you go, guys, this is creating more work for you. You go ahead and do your jobs. So obviously, if they do investigate him, like, what are they going to turn up, really? It's just, it's putting more pressure on them. Because in Russia, you kind of have to play by the rules of the bureaucracy all the time. You know, right. You have to jump through these hoops. And that's essentially what he's doing, is that he's making everybody jump through these hoops now. Because if they come out and say that, you know, he's a serial killer with three heads or whatever, you know, then he says, fine, well, if they're saying that, then that means a crime has been committed and you have to investigate it now. Right. Which I think it's a smart move, because they're playing a game with him, so he's, you know, playing a game right back.
And I would note that his first move was to call on prosecutors to open a criminal case against the Russia, one for slander. And then when that didn't happen, he came back and said, okay, FSB, investigate me for what they accused me of. So I think you're right. He's making everybody jump through hoops. But one thing that I'm wondering about, because one thing this did remind me of, remember back how the whole Bolotnaya case started and elements of it, when that program on Razvozhayev, the assistant to Ponomarev, was supposedly some kind of paid agent. I guess it was Georgian intelligence that time.
Yeah.
But that was a precursor to a very real criminal case, and Razvozhayev is still in prison right now. Do you think that they, I mean, I know we don't know, it's pure speculation, but are they thinking about putting Navalny away? Is he dangerous in this post-Panama Papers environment, in this declining economy, or is he in a box from their perspective?
I mean, personally, I say he's not dangerous, but then again, personally, I wouldn't have said that actually Putin needs a National Guard at this moment. I mean, I think this is the thing. It's actually not about what the objective facts on the ground might be. It's what the current mood in that small little toxic bubble in which policy is being set that we have absolutely no idea about, that we basically just simply have to see what emerges.
Yeah, and if you read the piece Evgeny Albats had in New Times this week about the depth of paranoia that has kind of infested the regime, you have to wonder if they might be getting ready to put Navalny away. Natalia?
It's interesting because, of course, everything that happens up there, they can't go directly to anyone and say, do this. Most of the time they're ruling by signal. So in this situation, I think with Russian TV, for example, with that whole hijab on Navalny, I don't think anybody necessarily went to them and said, look, you're going to do this, you're going to do A, B, and C, and it's going to be about Navalny. But I think they just kind of read between the lines and said and realized that they were expected to create this kind of quote-unquote sensation that would maybe possibly distract people from Panama Papers. It's like the danger of ruling by signal is that people do not what they're told, they do what they think they're expected to do, and they frequently overdo it. So as far as what's going on in the toxic bubble, I have no idea. You know, I'm not even going to bother with that. You know, for all I know, they're all sitting there and playing Quake or Doom or something, you know, not even thinking about what is going on.
Right.
And it's entirely possible, actually, because Putin gets a lot of his info from a very small group of people. So, and this small group of people doesn't like to look bad and make the president upset. So I don't even know if he's thinking about any of this. But on the other hand, you have all these people who are kind of like really the top managers. They're running around just, they're worried about their jobs, their apartments and their kids and their mistresses and whatever. They want to keep their positions. They want to keep their budgets. So what's going to happen now with regards to this TV show is anybody's guess, because what if somebody in the investigative committee looks at this and says, well, this means we have to act. It doesn't matter if it's true or not. What matters is that we're going to look bad to the Kremlin if we don't act on this now. So you never know. This is just it's kind of like this pseudo-Soviet, not really here or there kind of chaotic rule. And you don't know what's going to happen. But what you do know is that people are going to do their absolute best just to stay on their boss's good side.
Right. Well, I thought it was significant that it was plugged by Kislyov initially on his on Vestnaya Daily, on the flagship weekly news magazine program. That's when it was teased. It aired Wednesday, but it came out last Sunday night on Kislyov's show. Now, when Kislyov does that and spends as much time on a segment as he spent on this, that seemed to signal to me that it was one of these more direct things. Right,
because beyond Russia TV's kind of empire, it hasn't had as much pickup as one might have think. You know, there's certainly nothing that suggests that then, you know, it's not like all the other, you know, the newspapers and such like are that we know listen to the Natalia's absolutely right, listen to what they think is coming from the Kremlin. Mm-hmm. It's not as though everyone else seems to have been sort of as informed that this is a thing. Again, I mean, who knows? Because exactly. All it takes is precisely that middle-ranking person in Sledcom to think that this is a sort of a sign from the gods and act appropriately. But I think it's certainly actually it's at the moment ambiguous whether or not this is a real omen from the deities of the Kremlin or whether it's just simply someone who thought that it's what they were looking for.
Well, also, I think Kislyov ran with it. I think when they ran with it, I don't think they realized just how many mistakes were in it, because I know that when they actually broadcast the full thing, a lot of the stuff had been fixed.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think what happened is that they didn't realize that, you know, this story was kind of poorly pieced together. They ran with it, and then post factum they had to. So I just think there was just a lot of haste in what they were doing, and that doesn't necessarily mean they were directly pressured by anyone. All it takes is one person in that kind of the media chain to freak out about their job, and then you have this, and then all the other little cogs start spinning along with them.
To sum it all up and to kind of bring the two parts of the podcast together, I mean, we've had probably the weakest call-in program Putin has had in his presidency, I think, and we had this incredibly botched so-called investigative expose on Alexei Navalny. And you got to wonder if they lost their PR mojo at the end of the day.
I think PR mojo kind of it ebbs and flows, doesn't it? I think that they tend to learn from their little screw-ups as well as anybody does. So I think maybe in a few months or weeks, we're going to see like a big PR explosion.
Right.
I hope that's not going to happen, you know. And by explosion, I mean like an actual explosion. Let's hope that doesn't happen. You know, somebody's always getting yelled at after all this goes down. I'm sure that there was yelling after the Putin direct line thing. I'm sure there was yelling. I'm 100% sure there was yelling after the CIA thing as well, you know, because this is what happens. So many things in Russia basically get done by people screwing up and then getting yelled at and then trying to do a little better afterwards, that it could very well be that their mojo is actually going to be on the rise now.
Mark?
Yeah, I think we have to realize the extent to which actually PR depends really on the actual material you've got to sell. Lipstick on a pig only works if you have a thing about pigs. When it comes down to it, the reason why all this hasn't worked is precisely because actually there is nothing even faintly spinnable about the current situation. Whereas, for example, when we looked at Syria not that long ago, after all, there was, as it were, genuine material that they could spin to actually just, wow, my gosh, how, you know, we never realized the Russians would be this effective and they've completely reshaped the world and everything else. You have to have, as it were, in this term, at least a halfway decent product to be able to actually sell it as something dramatic. In both this case, I mean, obviously, firstly, there's absolutely no reality behind this investigation against Navalny. And it was just incredibly shoddily done by people who didn't know English and don't even know basic tradecraft.
And if you're going to implicate an existing CIA or it's an actual person who was in the CIA,
yeah,
you might want to implicate somebody who was actually in the CIA when this allegedly took place.
Valerie Plame left the CIA
in 2007. I can't believe they brought somebody that famous.
They just Googled, obviously, just make CIA person.
That was a head scratcher.
It was the first head they got. Mark is right. They Googled CIA agent. She was one of the top. And none of them said they just used her.
And like, I mean, calling William Browder, you know, Agent Solomon, I mean, apart from, let's put aside this sort of the little subliminal anti-Semitism of
right,
making the money man Solomon. But I mean, he used to work for Salomon Brothers.
Right.
So again, it just, I mean, no spy would ever come up with sort of, you know, cover names that are so obvious, let alone calling Navalny Agent Freedom. It makes him sound like a superhero, actually. Maybe he should like that.
He should t-shirts, Agent Freedom,
yeah,
if I were.
Exactly. I mean, you know, it's so badly done that there's nothing there. So they've had to try and create something out of just purely sort of supposition and fantasy. And likewise, Putin on the direct line, in some ways, I almost felt sorry for the poor galley slave. 3 hours, 40 minutes, with nothing to say, nothing that he could really sell. I think this is it. Actually, when it comes down to it, all Putin could say in the circumstances is just, yeah, life sucks at the moment. I feel your pain. Now moving on. And how do you make that into something positive and uplifting?
Well, that's a great note to wrap it up on. That's all we have time for today. I would like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow has been co-host Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University and an expert in Russia security services and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us from Moscow, also via Skype, has been journalist and playwright Natalia Antonova, former editor of the Moscow News and one of the more colorful figures on Russian social media. Thank you both for an enlightening discussion.
Thank you.
Always fun.
Always fun. I'd also like to thank our producers, Pavel Balak and Andreas Kunshina, who are filling in for Tanya Koncheva, just proving that you need two people to fill in for Tanya. I'd also like to thank my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. You can also follow Pavel's excellent Twitter feed at Pasha Butorin. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at RFRL.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.